Hello and welcome to today's episode of Pipe Up the Organ Podcast. I'm David Pipe, and today joining me is my colleague Tom Leach, who is our director of the school's singing programme. Tom, welcome.
Hi, it's great to be on this.
So we've got Tom on today primarily because he's giving Monday's recital, and we're particularly excited because this recital is going to be the first broadcast performance of Tom's new recording on the Regent Records label, which was made in Ripon Cathedral. Tom, could you tell us a bit about this, perhaps what's on it or how it came about?
Of course, it's had a very lengthy genesis, mainly due to my own inaction. So as I was wrapping up my time as assistant director of music at Ripon, in 2008, we had a choir recording scheduled with Regent Gary Cole recording. And on the front of that, I tacked on a couple of days of organ recording, recording Leighton's enormous Missa de Gloria, a piece by George Thalben Ball, and an early piece by Francis Pott. And kind of at the time, I had in mind, I'm going to go freelance and start doing a lot more recitals and playing. Got the disc down, and then kind of life happened, I suppose, and the disc has languished in Gary's archives on his hard disc for 10 years or so, slightly embarrassingly. So this seemed like a really good opportunity to spend the time dusting it off, making a digital-only release, which wasn't an option, you know, in 2008, really, and getting that hard work out there. It's been a very interesting experience listening back to my playing from 10 years ago.
Has it been a strange thing listening to your younger self? I mean, it's perhaps an odd comparison to make, but you think about organists such as Lionel Rogg, who record Bach two or three times through their career. Has it been odd, or perhaps a lovely thing, to listen to yourself playing in a sort of younger guise?
Yeah, it's certainly been interesting. And it's certainly the first time I've ever been mentioned in the same sentence as Lionel Rogg, whose musicianship and playing I couldn't hope to match. But I remember really clearly getting the first edit from Gary when it looked like the disc would come out then, you know, in 2009, and really not enjoying it at all. And I'm sure that was part of what led to kind of my inertia as well as busyness and then not ever getting around to finishing the release off. But listening back now, I mean, I'm certainly slightly regretful that I probably can't play as many notes as I could then. And it's certainly a programme full of notes. But there are things I really like. There are definitely things I would go back and do differently. But that's always the nature of recording, isn't it? And I think it's so true as a musician that you tend to hear and you tend to remember from recitals and performances the things you're not happy with, and you very rarely remember the bits that have given lots of other people lots of pleasure. So it's a kind of hard mental space to be in sometimes.
It is that difficulty, isn't it? When you've put something down, of course, say a concert or a play, when it's a, as you say, fleeting moment, it happened, it's in the moment of the moment, and people might remember things differently. But of course, when it's recorded for everyone to listen to for years to come, and I guess this is something where we have with YouTube, it is quite tricky, isn't it, to almost live with something, a split second decision you may have made during a recording session that you may think later on, why did I do that, why didn't I don't know, change registration or take a bit of time here or choose a different tempo.
It is, and that's the same listening to live recordings as well. And a lot of the time, of course, we just have to get over ourselves. You know, it's a very first world problem, isn't it? Worrying about whether you lingered long enough on a pair of semiquavers. And again, I don't make any great claims to artistry. I think if you're dealing with the absolute sort of pinnacle of your art, maybe it is a huge problem. But, you know, it's interesting the sort of categories, I think, where I listen back and think, I really enjoy a lot of the slow playing, I think, more than I enjoyed playing it at the time. But I listened to some of the virtuosic stuff, and now I kind of think, oh, I'd want more space, I'd want more kind of gravitas. And possibly that's a function of age. It might be a function of knowing I couldn't play it as quickly now.
And what made you choose that programme? Because they're all composers I'd heard of, but it's repertoire I certainly don't know myself. And I dare say many people wouldn't be familiar, for example, with the big Leighton Missa de Gloria, which is a huge work, as you say, but I don't think it's performed very much.
It isn't, and I came across it having to play the last movement for my finals recital at university. So I had the music and I sweated blood over this insane toccata style piece, which I really enjoyed learning at the time. And then, you know, thinking about recording, I wanted to steer clear of any classic repertoire because there are always going to be people who've got more profound things to say about it, I think. Much as I enjoy playing Bach and playing Brahms, I'm not sure that I've got anything to add at all to the recorded canon. So part of it was driven to do things that aren't recorded very much. It's music that I felt comfortable with at the time. I enjoyed playing it. I enjoyed the sort of ruggedness. I've just been writing the notes for the liner disc. And I think there's an interesting coincidental parallel with the building in Ripon with a lot of this music, really. You know, Leighton's piece is vast, it's very profound, very powerful at times, but it's also definitely not a perfect piece of music, which is good as it certainly in the hands of a not entirely perfect performer either. But Ripon's that kind of building, if you know it, that is very impressive. It's got these moments of great sort of profundity and grandeur as well, but it's also, you know, a real mess where, you know, they got halfway through remodeling it and then had all the finances confiscated, I think. So it's very rugged, but imperfect, but impressive at the same time. It's interesting that I think the music matches that.
It's a fine organ, isn't it? I've played a Ripon a couple of times, and I think it's arguably one of the finest organs in the region. What was it like working on that day in, day out? Because you were assistant director of music, your title there?
It was. So I played every day, and back then it was the sort of old school 7-8 services a week. You know, I did all the playing. And it was a wonderful instrument. I mean, I learned so much from doing that day to day. You know, my playing improved beyond measure during my time there. Particularly on the screen console, it was a lovely instrument to play. It hadn't had much done to it for sort of 30 years or so. So it didn't have, and at the time of recording, it didn't have all of the gadgets that we're kind of used to. You know, it didn't have a sequencer. It didn't have zillions of levels of memory to set registrations. So on Sunday mornings, you'd have to kind of reset all your settings halfway through the sermon during the first service in order to be ready for matins.
Oh, really? Wow.
Which often led to some very entertaining moments, you know, where you'd forgotten to change something and obliterated the choir for a second by accident. But yeah, it's beautiful. The Lewis pipework, I mean, I know it was changed a lot by Harrison's, but it's really lovely. And it was just a lovely building to play in. I've played it a few times since the restoration, and it's certainly got a much clearer sound now, which, you know, it's full of 30 years of dust and filth and bat droppings, I expect.
I'm thinking about quite a niche question now, but when you're recording it, you mentioned there was little gadgetry, which I guess lots of us are very used to now, sequences or acres and acres of memory for general pistons. Did you find yourself having to be quite judicious in the registration changes you made, or were you able to, perhaps you were able to reset it between each movement? Did you find that was a limitation, or perhaps it helped you thrive on creativity?
I think there was, you know, because we did it in two evenings. And the first evening, actually, I made this insane decision to catch the bus home back to Leeds. So I had less than 3 hours because I got to get on the 36 or whatever it was at 9:30. So it did. And I was looking back at the score, and there was a moment when I was listening to the edits then the other day thinking, why is there this amount of time between this section and that section? And actually, it's because I was doing some of the registration by hand. So it did. I found, you know, playing day to day, that the lack of memory channels and all that kind of slightly geeky stuff did make me think much more about the musicality of the instrument, the use of the instrument. It's not supposed to be a pun, but organically, you know, you're thinking of the registration not just for showing off or trying to make silly colours to make people laugh in a psalm or something tedious like that. But actually, you're trying to use it as a real instrument, which, of course, is one of the problems that organists and organ music faces, isn't it? That it's that remoteness and sometimes the mechanics of it all get in the way of communication.
It is difficult, isn't it? And I suppose Ripon, particularly when you're buried up in the organ with that screen console. Am I right? Is it Ripon that's got the hand, which you can operate a wooden hand, which would have been used to conduct the choir many years ago?
It does. It does. There's a little hand that sticks out of what would have been the support for the positif case, I guess. And there's a lever, and you can move the hand up and down, and that's then visible in the choir. So I spent a lot of time, actually, when I should have been practicing repertoire during the day in the cathedral quietly, just waving it up and down for tourists to take videos of. I should have had a hat to collect money in underneath. And it then tended to get used during evensong to acknowledge that you'd made some horrendous mistake. So you'd wave it up and down, which obviously happened quite a lot. What you couldn't do was ever reach it while you were playing. I did try a couple of times. Yeah, but the lever was just too far away from the console.
You'd have 7 feet long legs or something.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to think of a choir singing along to that conducting, but then I suppose it's extraordinary to think of a choir singing along to quite a lot of conducting you actually see, so perhaps it wasn't too different.
No, I think you're being too modest about your organ playing. Having heard you many times, I can confirm, and everyone else will agree with me on this point, that you're a very fine organist. But I think these days, it's probably fair to say you're known most of all for your work with choral music, be it as a conductor of a choral society, or I suppose even more so, running this very large school singing programme for the Diocese of Leeds, where we both work. Could you just tell us a bit about perhaps what makes up a typical week? I say typical, of course, knowing that everything at the moment is utterly atypical, but what might your typical, as it were, non-COVID week have looked like?
I'm not sure I can remember what a non-COVID week was like. It seems like we've been doing this for an eternity now. It's interesting, isn't it? Because so when I was doing this organ disc, I wouldn't have imagined that I'd be doing what I'm doing now. You know, it hadn't occurred to me that it was a possibility, really. But it's kind of all about choirs these days. I still love playing, and I miss being able to do so much practice. So generally during a week, I'm running our school singing programme, which sees about 4,500 children a week in schools across the diocese, and then has that kind of network of after-school choirs, so 18 choirs rehearsing at the cathedral in Bradford, Puddersfield, elsewhere. So administering that is a big job to do, keeping people happy some of the time at least. And then I do quite a lot of the delivery, so I work for a few primary schools where I go in and do the singing sessions, which is great. I absolutely love that work. I love going in to do whole class singing, trying to engage children who, you know, might not have access to that, and making singing something that doesn't require any kind of input for the children to be able to take part. So it hasn't got those barriers of having parents who are interested, or, you know, needing to buy an instrument or needing to practice. You can go in and you can achieve an awful lot in half an hour in terms of cultivating the normality of musical expression through the voice, I suppose, which, you know, ultimately is, you know, something that's got a huge impact on well-being, on spiritual life in the Catholic schools, and might make, you've got to hope it will make those children more interested, more confident in accessing any kind of musical culture as adults as well, and that some of the enormous barriers that are in place, I think, in classical music at the moment, might just get chipped away at by being determined to have access as broad as possible in school music. So I do the primary school stuff, and I work with some of our after-school choirs, the Cathedral Girls Choir and our Girls Choir in Bradford, who are both delightful groups to work with, and the privilege of doing a lot of broadcasting with them. And that's more of a musical challenge, and again, it's children who I think wouldn't be doing it if we weren't providing the opportunity. So that's a big responsibility then, to make sure that we're offering as much as we can musically in particular, but also in terms of a teaching engagement, in terms of being inspiring and preparing them for all that kind of raw talent that we've got, and that we've got and we're obliged to nurture. How we then prepare them so that they're able to access musical opportunities in later life as well. So I do all of that. I answer a lot of emails and do a lot of spreadsheets. And I do a choral society as well, Bradford Festival Choral Society, who are one of those grand old Yorkshire choirs. And they're delightful to work with, you know, very good set of trustees and very interested in innovation. And we've been rehearsing online during COVID. So, yeah, I'm not sure there is a typical week, really, but it's typically busy anyway.
Plenty of variety. And you mentioned broadcast. Could you tell us a little bit about the BBC work? And I guess a lot of people have seen you on Christmas morning, or at least perhaps have seen the back of your head on TV. Tell us a little bit about that Christmas service, because it's quite an unusual privilege or daunting task to be asked to do a live TV service, particularly on such a big and widely watched programme.
It was a lovely thing to do, and great to see the children really excelling in it. And you very modestly failed to mention your own involvement as the organist for that.
Oh, no one could see me. I was hidden.
Well, mercifully, there weren't many shots of me in it either. And there were lots of shots of the children looking great. Yeah, it's brilliant to have the opportunity. And I think for the children's choirs, that was with Bradford Catholic Youth Choir. So the girls' choir that I conduct and the boys' choir that my colleague Alex Kyle directs, with the set of wonderful tenors and basses as well. And then our junior choirs as well from that. So well over 100 children singing. And I think to see those children contributing to the national voice, you know, on Christmas Day, representing the Catholic Church, was very powerful and very moving, because it wasn't something great because they're kids. You know, isn't it great? They're doing so well because they're children. It was very high quality on its own terms. And I think those children having that responsibility, having to work, having to know that at 10 o'clock it's live, you know, that there are no excuses. You can't not do it because you're not feeling great or you're distracted by whatever else is going on. So it's a very powerful preparation for the world of work, I suppose, and taking individual responsibility, but also knowing that what you're doing has a wider impact. So all those, you know, well over a couple of million people who watch that broadcast are being impacted by the quality of what they're doing. And so I hope in terms of confidence and in terms of resilience, that has a really positive impact on the children. And yeah, for the musicians, the professional musicians involved, it's always absolutely terrifying to be doing that.
That red line never gets easier, does it?
It's kind of... It is terrifying, and I get more nervous the older I get about these things, I think. But at the same time, you've got to sort of knock that away as being slightly self-indulgent, I think, and do the preparation and get on with it. And really, it's quite an easy gig when you've got such lovely choirs to work with.
They did sound great. I mean, I probably had the worst seat in the house to hear the choir, but listening back on it, and certainly in all those rehearsals we did, I thought they rose to the challenge amazingly. And when you think, I think we did Mozart, and, you know, I should remember the rest of it. We certainly did a Mozart Mass, didn't we? Which is proper tricky music. And you think how well they sang that. That's huge credit, really, to the programme, isn't it? To prepare children to perform music of that quality, and to do it in such a sort of, I suppose, under such a big spotlight.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's great about that is that all of those children in the senior choirs who were doing the Mozart, who were doing the Praetorius, had joined the choirs as a result of singing in whole class singing with Alex or my other colleague working in Bradford, Charlotte Kitson at the time. So there you've got a model where they weren't dependent on somebody seeing a posh leaflet for a cathedral choir or a private school scholarship. They sang in class and they looked like they were excelling. The choral director thought they were really engaged and offered them through school a place in the choir. And so that way you're reaching a lot of children who I don't think would get those opportunities if the structure wasn't in place. And that kind of access is a huge problem, because so many institutions, I think, you know, you look at the choirs, there's such a lack of diversity on display, and it's because if they are making any efforts to broaden access, they're very token, they're very project-based, and there's a sort of lack of sustainability about it.
I guess it's a big issue, isn't it? And we could spend the whole podcast and more talking about this, but I know you've got some very, I think, socially aware ideas and progressive ideas about all this. How do you think the Leeds structure and design could be relevant to the rest of the country? I mean, you know, we've both worked for very established cathedrals in previous lives with a sort of typical choral foundation, quite different from where we both work now. How do you think this could be rolled out? And I am thinking, if I'm honest, about what's going on at the moment with COVID, because we're all very unsure about how our profession is going to come out of the wash after this. Do you think the Leeds model could have more relevance and application around the country?
I do. There's never a one-size-fits-all model, you know, I'd be the first to acknowledge that. But I think, or I hope, that issues that arise out of the pandemic in terms of the lack of financial security for a lot of cathedral choirs maybe make people think in a way that is a little bit more compatible with social equality, social justice. And you're right, I mean, I could spend far longer than the rest of the podcast.
Whole series of podcasts.
On my soapbox about this, definitely. But I think what I'm passionate about is that opportunity, is that the quality of opportunity. And I see so much amazing talent in our choirs. But it's often when children come to us, it's completely unformed. And I think of some of the people you work with, you know, Moses, for instance, an astonishing musical facility.
Yes.
That would have gone, you know, fairly unnoticed by anyone. You know, Holy Rosary in Chapel Town, had Sally not kind of nurtured him and pushed him towards the cathedral choirs and then learning the organ. And that's replicated across the programme. You know, the girls' choir that I work with, they're children who are far more astute, far more able musically, I think, than I was at that age, but without any of the opportunities that I enjoyed. You know, I went to state schools, but state schools that had fabulous music departments and, you know, wonderful music teachers at secondary school and at sixth form, with good facilities and a real determination to nurture ability and push people, you know, challenge people as well. So I think our model, where it's based in the state sector, it's based in areas of really very extreme deprivation, you know, in Leeds, I think 6 or 7 of the schools we work with have some of their catchment drawn from the lowest 1%, or is it the highest 1%, the worst 1% of deprivation in the country, which is absolutely extreme poverty. And then I find it ironic that so many cathedrals and so many cathedral choirs started with the aim of nurturing the poor, and they sing, you know, on a daily basis, you know, about exalting the humble and meek in the Magnificat, but actually they're entirely invested in private education. And for however many bursaries you have for children, I kind of think of the kids I know, you know, they're never going to access those opportunities because it's far more complicated than throwing 30 grand at somebody for a scholarship. The poverty and the inequality is far more entrenched than that, for that to be a solution. So, you know, I think wouldn't it be incredible if King's, Cambridge or St Paul's got rid of their choir schools and drew their choirs from the local state schools. I'd imagine, actually, with a bit of imagination, they wouldn't lose very much quality at all, you know, in the long term, but they would have an astonishing transformative impact on children that they worked with. I don't think that's probably a view that they would share at the moment. But I think there's a lot of very lazy thought about how cathedral choirs run, and a lot of discrimination, you know, to not put it too bluntly. I don't think it's necessarily deliberate, but I think it's definitely institutional and part of a system that wants it to be easy to get the output easy for the directors of music to run it. And maybe they could spend a bit more time thinking about equality and less about which psalm it is that day, possibly.
Yes. We dread Psalm 78, don't we, with all of its many, many verses.
That's one thing I don't miss.
I think I'd lose concentration now, that long a psalm. Thinking about the school singing programme, now, I think spearheaded by you and also by our colleague Ben Saunders, there's been a remarkable move of your work to an online platform. Could you tell us about that? Because I know a lot of people who are watching the organ recitals on Mondays will also be aware there's this weekly school singing programme feed going out on YouTube with some variety and content to be rivaled by very few, I think. Can you tell us a bit about how that's been done and, you know, what some of your aims are with that?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I'll pull it back to the organ recording temporarily, because I was listening to it and sort of trying to find, you know, wrong notes in these sort of extraordinary textures in this Francis Pott piece. And then I think about 20 minutes later, I was having to record myself pretending to be a banana. And I kind of like it. It's the variety is great, and it contextualizes a lot of difficulties, I think, that we might have as musicians. You know, we're agonizing over whether we misread a chord, but then we're having to do something ridiculous. So we moved the whole program online very quickly, with a lot of tears, I think, at times, and smashed mugs and phones and silly arguments. But the output has then been that we've done daily singing sessions on YouTube. We've had about, well over, looking today, 25,000 views of those. Great. Obviously, you've put all your stuff online, which is fantastic as well. And that came out of that determination that at this time, actually, music is one of the things that we need the most, I think, the children need the most. Such a big impact on well-being. And it is so hard for schools often to deliver it. I'm hesitant to record it for posterity, but I'm pretty sure that my children's school has sent out almost nothing to do with art and music. And, you know, we've got to be in that gap. We can't abandon the children that we're working with because we're worried about how we look on camera. So, yeah, it's been a big learning curve. But it's the most wonderful thing for me about it has been being able to watch my colleagues work and see how they present things, learn their repertoire. And aside from the technological skills that I've had to learn very quickly, I've learned so much about my own job by watching the very high quality of, you know, Lucy, the two Lucys, Charlotte, Alex, Will, and stuff that I've just picked up and thought, gosh, I've got to do that next time I do a session. So it's been tough, but also extremely stimulating.
There's a good number of subscribers too, I think. Are we somewhere near 1,000?
We're inching towards 1,000, I think. We've got about, as we're recording this, I think we've got about 30 to go. So hopefully by the time this goes out, we might have 1,000 subscribers, which would look nice.
Do just remind me, I think I know, but do remind me of the link to get onto YouTube, because it could be there are 30 people listening to this podcast who are spurred on to take us over the 1,000 mark.
I think what those people want to do is they want to listen to some of this really hardcore Leighton whilst having me dancing as a banana on the screen at the same time. If that's not a tempting offer, I don't know what is really. So the link which will take you through to the YouTube channel is www.schoolssingingprogramme.org.uk. And that takes you through to the YouTube channel, which has got all of our daily Key Stage 2 sessions and some early years stuff as well, which is really, really lovely, beautifully delivered. And some singing for older children as well, some Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4. I think it's pretty good for adults, you know, if you want a quick sing.
Oh, it's great. Well, I sent a link to the people in my choral society around York, and I think a lot of them found it really interesting. I think it's also fair to say that Lionel Rogge probably never danced as a banana whilst recording his Bach. But I want to go back to organ with that slightly tenuous link there. Do you have any plans for future repertoire you might like to learn? Obviously, you've got a lot of time taken up by your choral day job, but thinking back to your roots as an organist, is there anything on your bucket list or wish list you'd really like to learn?
It's interesting how it changes over time, isn't it? When I was playing a lot, I had all sorts of sort of crazy virtuosic things I wanted to learn. I found a copy of Patrick Gower's Toccata the other day that I sort of embarked on learning. I still enjoy that kind of repertoire, that visceral feeling of playing, the sort of physicality of playing and stretching yourself and stretching those connections between the mind and the fingers and feet. But I'm definitely succumbing to that cliche of kind of going back to simpler music with age. So, you know, in terms of Bach, of course, I think, you know, I've never learnt all of the trio sonatas. I'd love to go back to those. And when we did Klavierübung three together a few years ago, I was thinking I must learn the movements that I don't play in that. So I'd love to go back to Bach. One of Francis Potts' pieces I just loved when I was a teenager, which is a bit weird, was his huge organ symphony, Christus. And he very kindly gave me, because we knew each other a bit, because his wife was my godmother's sister. So I knew them a bit as a child. He very kindly gave me a photocopy of his manuscript of Christus, which is on these enormous sheets of paper. And the most amazing script. It's just beautiful. So I'd love really to have a go at learning that. I don't know when I would ever find the time, and I'm sure it's both musically and physically beyond me at the moment. So it would be lovely to be doing more practice. It would be lovely to carve out the time to do that every day. So you never know. I'm full of good intentions that probably won't be followed up.
And I realise I haven't really asked you in detail about what we're going to hear on Monday, which I guess is a large purpose for our podcast today. Could you tell us a bit about the programme? We've mentioned Leighton being on there in a little detail, but what are we going to hear in Monday's YouTube recital?
So I'm opening with George Thalben Ball's Poema and Toccata Biorma. So Thalben Ball, obviously extraordinary pianist, extraordinary musician, choir trainer, didn't write an awful lot of music. And there's a toccata that he wrote in the early 1970s when he was awarded an honorary degree as Birmingham City organist. And then I think in 1980, he wrote a poem to go on the front of that. So that's a lovely pair of pieces. And if you know the Thalben Ball elegy, a sort of Edwardian, romantic, very luscious Elgarian sound, this is utterly different. It's like a French organist who's kind of having a dream about playing in England, perhaps. I don't know. It's got that kind of luscious French sound world. The virtuosity is brilliant. You know, it's really Rachmaninoff-like in terms of its piano figuration in the toccata. And there's a great recording that I wish I'd heard when I did the original recording of Thalben Ball playing the toccata on YouTube.
Oh, really?
Okay. It wasn't available when I put it down. And again, although not all the notes are the ones written down, I suppose that's his prerogative as the composer, just the musicality in his playing is fabulous. It's you must go and listen to it. It's really, really cool. And then I recorded all of Arvo Pärt's organ music at Leeds Cathedral a while ago. Slightly traumatic recording process, but I kind of survived it. And I'm going to include Spiegel im Spiegel in this recital. So we hear the cathedral organ, and that's an interesting one to do online, isn't it? Because I think it requires almost to be in the space a little bit more because of the sense of there's no movement, it's so static. But I think if you close your eyes while you're listening to it will work.
And it's a beautiful piece, isn't it?
It is. And it does work nicely in the organ transcription. It's that kind of coolness about the instrument, the detachment that works rather well. And then I'm playing two movements from Leighton Missa de Gloria, which are the Credo and the final movement, Ite Missa Est, Go the Masses Ended. And by bizarre coincidence, but I think it's rather lovely and perhaps says that it is the right thing to do to get this recording out, The Leighton was premiered 40 years ago on June the 29th for the day of the recital, which is a bizarre coincidence.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, so that's nice. I'll listen to that and think of that. And the music's great, you know, it's not all for the faint-hearted, but the Credo in particular really shows off the organ and Rippon and what a musical instrument it really is. You know, you can really turn it into something that doesn't just feel like an organist dictating to the world from their console. It's very, very kind of introverted and draw you into it. So I hope people enjoy it anyway.
And perhaps you could tell us also where to look out for your recording. You said it's going to come online as a digital download recording, but where should we look for that? Because I think after Monday, a lot of people are going to want to search that out.
Well, I'm hoping by the time this podcast goes out that I'll know slightly more about it. At the moment, we haven't got a release date for it because we're just looking at the edits. And, you know, with that gap of 10 years, it's going to be a slightly lengthier process just to check the odd moment that needs tidying up. So we'll find a way, and hopefully by the time the video of the recording goes out on the 29th on Monday, we'll be able to put a bit of information in about when it's going to be released. And it will be available, of course, on iTunes to download. I think Regent sell the high quality downloads via their own website as well. So it'll be on a Regent Records label. And I guess it will be on Spotify and things like that eventually. So I'm excited for it to come out. And I'm really delighted, David, that you've given me the opportunity to showcase it in your recital and talk about it today.
Well, thank you. It's unusual opportunity to be able to premiere a recording, particularly one made 10 years ago. So we are looking forward to that hugely. So just as a final plug then, of course, don't forget Tom's recital is on Monday the 29th at 1:15, as ever on our YouTube channel, www.leofflive.org.uk. Do listen to that. And next week, my guest will be Sean Montgomery, who is going to be giving the recital in July. And I'll tell you the date now because I've forgotten it off the top of my head. Sean Montgomery is playing on the 3rd of July, and his programme, I think, will include some lovely Italian pieces from the organ of Bradford Cathedral, amongst other things. So, Tom, a final thank you. Thanks ever so much for being our guest.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely to have the chance to chat. I'm really looking forward to the recital, and thanks for putting that on.
Lovely,
as well.
And thanks for being part of this. And thank you again to all of our listeners. Do tune in next week and take care. Goodbye.